approved the revitalization of cities was upheld by the Supreme Court. We won the battle, but we lost the war because half the states then tightened down the local states' abilities to do the same thing, to revitalize urban areas. That was the Kelo issue.
Is there
does anybody have one question? Or okay, we're zooming along here.
Okay. Good afternoon.
Let's see. Where is this?
Okay. What I would like to talk about in the time we have is two issues. One is the basic background of how health is related to the built environment, particularly as it relates to older adults, and then spend the rest of the time on what Kathy asked me to talk about, which is health impact assessment. But I think you need the background on what that relationship is before we go into health impact assessment. Okay, good. We were asked to say no disclosure. I think, in fact, it's not completely true because we all have a vested interest in what the future is like for us and for our kids. So. Okay, this is the summary of how built environment and community design are related to health. And I'll spend a little bit of time on each of these, but not a lot. It's a whole hour talk in and of itself. Related to how we use our land, obesity, physical activity, cardiovascular disease, water quantity and quality, these are things that we do have some control over when we design and build communities. Added to that probably should be access to food, because how we design communities, are people getting access to better food or not? Automobile dependency, a big part of built environment, has a number of health outcomes, air pollution, asthma, climate change issues, car crashes, injuries. I'll go a little bit more into a few of these. And then social processes, mental health, social capital, environmental justice, a whole range of issues there. The one that really pops up at the top does tend to be physical activity, and you'll hear about that in many talks. And I think Chris mentioned some of these. What happens in suburban development is places tend not to be very walkable, and it's very much a design issue. The distances that you see in that slide in the upper right are similar to the distances in the more traditional development in terms of how far it is from the school to the homes to the mall to the apartments and so forth, but they're not connected. They're just not built to allow people to walk, whereby in the more traditional neighborhood, similar distances, but with the connections that at least give walking and biking an option. And you can see this flying in almost any major city. If little Johnny lives in one of those houses, his friends can live a few hundred yards away and no way to get to his friend's house. This actually brings up one of the potentially dead malls that Chris mentioned. Here you have some relatively walkable neighborhoods, but then we put in impregnable barriers that make it so that it's not going to be that convenient to walk from those houses into a mall like that. Parks are a very central part of how we design communities, but even how we design our parks can vary from ones that are very accessible and ones that aren't. The one on the left is a place that basically is designed only to drive to. The one on the right, you can just about see some houses in the background. People can walk out the door and get into the parks. And then we get some really horrible designs that are really based on what kind of rules and zoning and other issues that we operate under. I mean, can you imagine building a foam pole like that in the middle of the street and just say, well, cars can find their way to drive around it, and yet we tolerate that with sidewalks. Similarly, disconnected sidewalks, fairly common in various parts of the country because the political will isn't there to say that's just totally unacceptable. Then we get choices like this, the transportation choice. I think transportation is really one of the major issues in health and built environment. This is Atlanta. Proposed 23-lane highway because the 16 or 18 lanes that they have there now aren't sufficient. And, you know, if you looked at the health consequences of a choice like that, you know, one of my biases says if you have enough people to fill 23 lanes, do you maybe have enough people to put into a transit system that doesn't exist in that area? Injuries, another major part of built environment, leading cause of death in younger people, tens of thousands of deaths, millions of non-fatal injuries a year, big dollars in costs related to how we build our environment. Social capital, also related to how we build our environment, defined as social networking, civic engagement. It's your interaction with your community and with the people around you. Having good places that you can socialize encourages social capital. That's Portland, a place that, you know, is a very pleasant place to visit or live. Smart growth was mentioned briefly earlier, and I want to discuss it from the point of view of how it how it affects older adults. So it talks about higher density, more contiguous development, means that older adults can be physically nearer to some of their friends and family. Having green spaces gives older adults places to walk and to socialize. Mixed land uses means there's more destinations that can be reached. The balanced transportation alternatives. Older adults at some point reach the point where they can't drive, and so better choices mean they have other ways to get to places they need to. Architectural heterogeneity, housing options, and you were just hearing how many families will have kids and how many will not. One of the issues in some areas is what's called accessory dwelling units or mother-in-law suites, and when zoning allows that and encourages it versus forbids it, makes a big difference in quality of life for older people. Having more social opportunities as you get more heterogeneity economically and racially. Part of this is how we choose to make capital investments and balancing it between the suburbs and the cities. And overall, it takes regional planning to make these smart growth happen. Okay, that basic background, some of you have heard that, some of you have not. What I want to spend the rest of my time on is health impact assessment. Health impact assessment is related to environmental impact assessment that most of you have heard of. The formal definition is that it's a collection of procedures and tools, so it's not a single tool, by which projects, policies, and programs, so it covers a wide range of opportunities, can be evaluated based on their effects on the health of the population, and particularly the distribution of those effects within the population, looking at environmental justice and social equity issues. Our vision in the ideal world is that community planners and others who are making, and zoning boards and others who are making those decisions about what our community will look like and how we're going to design it, will care and want to know what are the health impacts of the decisions that they're making. And that local health officers will build those links and work with those decision makers and use health impact assessment as a tool to convey that health information to those decision makers. Basic steps in conducting a health impact assessment, 6 steps. Screening is this a project or policy for which health impact assessment would be useful? If it's not useful, stop right there. If it is useful, proceed. Scoping is which types of health impacts assessments should be included. And it's really the list you saw earlier, what are the health impacts of the built environment. Risk assessment is trying to tell how will people be affected, how much and how many and which ways. And whatever can be done quantitatively is done quantitatively, but some of it has to be qualitative. Recommendations are looking at a policy or a project and saying, how can we make it better from the health point of view? Can we encourage the good parts of it, find ways to mitigate the parts that have adverse health consequences? Reporting is getting that information back to decision makers to try to influence the decision. Health will generally not drive the decision, but should be one of the factors being considered by city council, zoning boards, and other decision makers who are deciding what your community will look like. Evaluation is looking at, did it make a difference? Monitoring, seeing what happens over time. The scoping part, as mentioned, is a very similar list to what you saw at the beginning. Everything from physical activity, air, water quality, the food, motor vehicle, noise, mental health, social justice, gets into things like access to jobs and stores and destinations. So the whole range of issues that can be included under scoping. Different health impact assessments will include different components of scoping depending on what's relevant in that setting. Some of the issues that come up pretty quickly when we talk about health impact assessment, one is voluntary versus regulatory. A voluntary health impact assessment is typically used by a local health officer to inform the decision maker, planning commission, zoning board, whoever it is. It's simpler, it's less expensive, it's less litigious, and it's probably more politically acceptable. The drawback to voluntary is it may be less likely to be used or listened to if it's voluntary. The alternative is modeled on environmental impact statements, making a regulatory requirement that we look at the health impacts of any project or policy being proposed. It gets more complex. It's going to be less politically acceptable, adding new regulations. And it can get more litigious. We've been told that for an environmental impact statement that essentially every sentence should be legally defensible. Well, if I have to write under those circumstances, it's very hard to write a whole lot of sentences. But it will get used more if it is required. There is a relationship already between health impact assessment and environmental impact statements. Logically, the health components can fit within the environmental impact process. And it does make it necessarily regulatory. But we have examples of where it has worked well. And the actual wording of the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA law of about 1970, is written in such a way that health can fit in and should fit in. It's typically been ignored over the years, but it's slowly in some places that health component of an environmental impact statement is starting to get more attention. Another part that shows up within health impact assessment pretty quickly, particularly for people who are coming from the environmental impact background, is what can we do qualitative and what can we do quantitative? And the problem there is quantitative tends to be difficult on a lot of the issues about health that we care about. The qualitative is what is the direction of the proposed policy or of the intervention. So it's easier to predict. We build a sidewalk, people walk more. That's fairly straightforward. There'd be some evidence to support that. People wouldn't argue with that a whole lot. The trouble is, without any numbers, that's much harder to use in a cost-benefit model. And many decisions, obviously, are looking at the economic components of it, which is important. But if you go to quantitative, it's hard to get the data sometimes. And so a hypothetical example would be you build a sidewalk and 300 people live within 200 yards, will walk 15 minutes more a day, lose 4.7 pounds, and will prevent 1.2 heart attacks over 2.7 years. I mean, that's garbage. I mean, I don't think we could ever get to models that would get at that level. In reality, we build you a trail, and I can tell you the last 10 trails we built had the following usage from a very low number to a high number, and on the new trail, it's going to be somewhere in this very wide range of what we saw on the last 10 trails. That's fine, but it's not a very precise estimate. I don't think we're going to get a great estimate. So my feeling is we need to convince the policymakers do the right thing or not, but not to expect perfect numbers and perfect modeling on everything that is in the right direction. There are some things we do have numbers for. This was some work we did a few years ago looking at walking to transit. We know that people who use transit tend to walk at one or both ends of a transit trip. And using data from the U.S. Department of Transportation, they have a National Household Travel Survey of several hundred thousand people of what their travel, how they travel. And of that several hundred thousand, there were 3,000 transit users. So we looked at the walking to and from transit from the 3,000 transit users nationally representative, and found that about a quarter of all transit users are getting at least 30 minutes a day of walking, and the median was about 19 minutes a day. So walking and the physical activity is very much a part of transit use. So it's one of the closer links between built environment and health. If you build transit, a built environment component, you are helping physical activity. I want to give a couple of examples of health impact assessment. This is the only one I have that was clearly focused on older populations. This was some work done by Rajiv Bhatia and his colleagues in San Francisco and Oakland. And there was a proposed low-income senior housing project that also included retail, but adjacent to major highways. And so they got some community input and said, well, what are some of the issues here? You can just about see it in the picture there, the major interstate running next to it. There's some existing retail they wanted to expand. And then there's some land just above the retail next to the highway where the senior housing would go. Major concerns, particularly from the community, had to do with noise and air quality and safety and crime and what would be in the retail that would be useful to the elder residents. And so looking at those issues and who would be affected and how came out with some recommendations for what can be done about the noise in the air and traffic calming and security and so forth. And we're able to make a good serious list of recommendations that got to the developers of here's things that would make it better for the older adults who are going to live there. And the developers had good interactions with the communities and didn't take every recommendation, but at least made some changes because these health messages were put in front of them with practical solutions. Cost is always going to be an issue. So if some of the solutions are outrageous prices, some of them aren't going to happen. And, you know, we've heard of ones where basically the developer looks at it and says, okay, which are the ones that cost less? I'll take those, and the ones that cost more, I won't. Well, I see that as a success. You don't get everything, but at least it's in the right direction. A couple of other examples of health impact assessments, also this one by Rajiv Bhatia in San Francisco, looked at some redevelopment projects in San Francisco. Basically, they were going to tear down some older housing, low-income housing, and build some fancy apartments and condos and make lots of money for the developer. Well, by looking at the health consequences of displacing the low-income people and showing that there are some adverse health consequences of losing housing, And he was able to actually, in this case, work within the environmental impact statement process to affect the permitting process so that the developer ended up was required to provide one-to-one replacement housing for everyone being displaced, obviously in the health interest of the people being displaced. The developer still did fine, was able to build his fancy apartments and condos, but made a real difference of the health of the people who were going to be displaced. And one that we've worked on in Atlanta, there's a proposal for a light rail loop that would circle the city on existing abandoned or mostly abandoned trails that would connect neighborhoods, redevelop some mixed-use property, some open to mixed use, some lesser used property, and looked very positive. Everything we heard about it, the trails and the parks and so forth, very positive for the health of the city. So we took this on with Georgia Tech and Catherine Ross to say, could we use health impact assessment to look at the positive parts of promoting health to encourage a good project to go forward? So health impact assessment is not just about let's stop the bad stuff, but let's encourage the good stuff when it is being considered. And ended up initially just providing some basic information on, you know, why walking and biking is good for you and having trails is good for you and having transit is good for you and so forth. But then eventually with some Robert Wood Johnson funding did the 200 plus page report that, you know, looks at all in more detail and then ends up with a series of recommendations, a few of which are here, which include such things as, why is it taking 25 years? If you could do it quicker, you could get those health benefits sooner. Can we get public health at the table as some of the more smaller scale decisions are being made, making sure affordable housing is in there and the distribution of park acreage, you know, fairly treats the population. But from what we understand at this point, some of the decision makers on this project are in fact looking at the health recommendations as part of the process. So it really can contribute to better health. And I'll wrap up in just a minute. I want to mention a few of the types of things that can be done in the built environment to help older adults. We mentioned accessory dwelling units. Certainly sidewalks are a major part. Walking is the most prevalent physical activity basically everywhere. It's particularly valuable for older adults because it's convenient for them if they have places they can walk. Having transit systems that are user-friendly, having wheelchair ramps, audible crossing signals, clear signage, things for elderly people, but they also help other people with disabilities of all ages. And basically, if you help the most vulnerable parts of your society, you're really helping everybody. So that, you know, that better sidewalk that helps the older person really helps all of us have a better environment. An example of design making a difference. I mean, here you're looking very clearly at a ramp doesn't cost all that much. If you design it in, there is access to that building for that person in a wheelchair. If it's not there, there is simply no access to that setting. So let me end with that. I want to mention a couple of websites. We have a CDC Healthy Places website that has a lot of this information on it, and EPA has a Smart Growth website that also has a lot of good information on it. So thank you.
Questions for AI?